Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hello and welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast. This is your host, the Progeny.
And I am...
the Patriarch.
The Patriarch.
Yes.
Patriarch Man.
Yes, we're also joined by the Professor. And those would be our superhero names, I suppose. We're coming from the Pilgrims Podcast cave.
Striking fear into the hearts of, you know, children everywhere. Patriarch Man.
Watch out for
a grumpy, curmudgeonly, middle-aged, bald guy. He's Patriarch Man. He doesn't even have
a cape.
That
sounds a lot like the Kingpin.
Well...
maybe he's like your, kind of your...
I had to put on a few pounds.
Well, that's true.
And start dressing a lot snappier.
Well, since we're at it, I guess we could tell the story behind the whole names on the Pilgrims Podcast, which isn't much of a story, but it's basically one day I said, hey, you know, podcasting is fun. And you said, we ought to do a podcast. And I said, yeah, we could do like this father-daughter thing. And you said, you can't call me daddy.
That sounds like something I would say.
Yeah. And I'm like, I can't call you daddy. What should I call you? And you said,
She said, with tears welling up in her eyes, big
yes,
liquid tears.
I quickly turned away and looked out the window, hoping he wouldn't notice. And you said, what about something cool like Patriarch? And I said, that sounds lame. And you said, you can be the Prodigy. And I'm like, that sounds even lamer. Anyway, that's I guess...
this is the 17th episode. Who would have thunk it?
Yeah, who...
Batman.
Yep. Holy smokes, Batman. So, yeah, that's... Of course, it took us a long time to come up with our name. I can't remember what our original title was. We went through several, but...
I don't know.
But I was reading the Pilgrim's Progress at the time, and I thought, hey, that would be fun. So...
and so, we had our legal department look into the, you know, the use of that.
Yep.
And, had to send some of the boys over to rough up a couple people before we could get the domain name, but, you know, it turned out okay.
Yeah, yep, and now...
we're walking again.
Yep. All our enemies, their domain names,
yeah,
they redirect to our website now. Right. Oh, by the way, I had somebody, a gospel girl who follows us, mentioned to... that she thought that Tacitus, our friend, was just some anonymous web person who had called in. You could not be more wrong. Tacitus is a little bit indescribable, but he's somebody indescribable.
Near and dear to our hearts.
Well, near and dear.
Yes.
Near anyway. He was in the room with us, which was which I suppose. You know, since we're going to explain that kind of little bizarre incident in the Pilgrim's
Progeny Boy.
Progeny Boy. No, no, he isn't. But he's...
he may or may not be the illegitimate son of Alexander the Great.
That's true. Yes, he's always talking about Alexander the Great. Alexander is his hero. And he's got a working theory about America's youth that he's been explaining to us, and he's even got the statistics down. He says that 97% of all young and middle-aged people, but especially young people, teenagers, you know, are rogues. The other 3% consists mostly of people just like him.
Anyway,
it's been entertaining. Anyway, Tacitus, yeah, he's entertaining. But I would say this, that when we did have him on the show, we didn't tell him that he was going to be on the show. He was here with us. We were hanging out, and I grabbed the computer, and we were about to record, and I said, "Hey, Tacitus, you're going to be on the show," and he didn't believe me until we were about 20 seconds into the show. And I ought to post the unedited tape sometime just for the heck of it, because it's a very amusing experience. Even if you don't know who Tacitus is or don't know any of the context, the poor guy didn't know what he was doing. It was hilarious. I enjoyed it. Anyway, moving on. Okay. Well, we did have two comments, but I went ahead and responded to one on the blog, so I guess we'll just go ahead and mention Yankee Gospel Girl's comments. She said that she agreed with me on the painted veil, which I think is evidence of good judgment. She mentioned that we didn't discuss the original novel, which I haven't read. In fact, I'm still working my way through A Room with a View at the moment, but I have not read that, so maybe I'll read it sometime. But, yeah. And she mentions Casablanca and wonders, is it wrong to name it as a favorite romance when the central romantic chemistry is taking place between two unmarried people, while one of them is married? Who'd for thought? We watched that movie last year for the first time.
What movie?
Casablanca.
Oh.
I really liked it. I recommend some of Steve Gradonis' thoughts on that are pretty good. He kind of talks a little bit about how even though the movie definitely has its issues on that, it's a movie that, by and large, celebrates virtue. Everybody does the right thing at the end. And, it's not necessarily making you want them to do the right thing, but you're kind of relieved that they do the right thing. I don't know. So.
But they've got Paris.
Yeah, they've still got Paris, so it's all okay.
It's like saying, we had high school.
Yeah.
Yeah. You bump into an old flame in the Piggly Wiggly, and you say, we always had high school. We've always got high school. I don't get it.
Do you often bump into old flames in the Piggly Wiggly?
It has happened, but I don't go up and say,
so if they were going to make this kind of steamy romance about your life in black and white with fedoras and everything, it would be called Piggly Wiggly instead of Casablanca.
It would be Cast Golf or Cast Away or Cast of Clowns or Cast of Idiots or a Cast of Thousands, but
yeah.
I don't know where I'm going.
I think
we need to change this before the matriarch comes in here, and I have a lot of explaining to do.
Well, this week. Oh, before we.
But and then getting back to Cecil and Cecil.
We were talking about the pronunciation of Cecil Vise's name.
Yes, there's a big difference between guys that go by Cecil and guys that go by Cecil. I just want to say that. I think it's an important point.
There you have it, folks.
It's just, it's the guys over at the Art of Manliness would frown upon the pronunciation of Cecil. That's all I got to say about that.
I have a feeling that they would frown on anybody being named Cecil or Cecil.
Cecil's okay.
Is it?
There's an engineer that I have an acquaintance with. I have to give you his name. His name is Cecil Hicks, which is a great name. And
that's a pretty great name.
It's a great name. And he's a good guy. He's a great guy. But it's, Cecil Hicks. So, anyway, I don't want to get him in trouble. I'm talking about Cecil on it, but he is a good guy. And then I just saw the thing on the, real quickly, they go back to the Iowa Hawk was doing over here on the, he was talking about the English language. Did you see that?
Oh,
the
yeah.
The Twitter thing?
Yeah, that
he
was
says,
pretty
English
funny.
Is difficult. English is difficult, but it can be mastered through tough, it can be understood through tough, thorough thought, though. That's priceless. English can be weird. It can be understood, though.
It can be,
it can be understood through tough, thorough thought, though.
Okay. English really is an evil language. I mean, but yeah, I'm trying to learn Spanish right now, which is, I just think, a much simpler language than English. Much more easy to understand. Much more orderly. It's just not as bizarre.
I have a tough time with English.
Yeah. Well. Okay. Well, before we completely leave the topic of our last podcast, you were talking about.
Let's leave it. Can we?
Well, quickly. I wanted to read this quote because it's from Chesterton, and I love Chesterton. And he said, the whole pleasure of marriage is that it is a perpetual crisis. And we were talking about how kind of all the tension leaves once a marriage is becomes, once you get married. But he also talks, he says that marriage is a jewel to the death that no man of honor should decline. And, you know, I think that he at least, he's saying that it's not something that is apathetic, you know.
A jewel to the death.
Yes.
I thought you said jewel. I thought you said jewel as in J, jewel.
We've had this problem before.
Duel. Marriage is a duel to the death, which no man of honor should decline.
I think that's an incredible phrase.
I'm not sure I get it.
Well, somebody's, you know.
You don't like duels.
I don't. Yeah, but this is one of those where you're not necessarily killing the other person.
The guys over The Art of Manliness think duels are a good idea.
Somehow, I'm not surprised.
Not to the death. But just to beat the sense in the guy that's wrong, or you know, there's an argument there for that. I think that's a neat idea, because it would save a lot of court costs.
It depends on who you're talking about. Some people need to, like, you know, if you went to Berkeley. And there were a bunch of guys who were having some little discussion over something, and they hate each other. It would probably solve a lot of problems if they just got into a punching match.
They would never get to that point because they have no honor.
All of our Berkeley listeners. Yep, and we know there were lots of them.
And so, but you know, I don't know. I think that's neat. But that would be the problem is nobody's. Nobody would have enough honor to actually do that. I don't think so. I mean, there'd be a few, all in the South, and maybe one or two in Chicago.
Not that we're entire at all stereotypical there. Not in Chicago.
I said in one or two in Chicago.
Okay, one or two in Chicago. All right, maybe Illinois, or
well,
maybe a few up north in general. Okay, well, we're going to start out by kind of covering a little bit of the history of, superheroes haven't been around for all that long, honestly. They got their start in the 20th century. The very first mention of the word superhero was in 1917, I believe. The format got its start with the Scarlet Pimpernel, who was a character invented by a lady named Baroness Ortsey, who wrote a play, and then she turned it into a novel, and then a series of novels, and it's about a caped crusader who goes and rescues people from the French Revolution. He's an English aristocrat who's, by day, he's the playboy idiot, you know, and then by night, he's
Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, I mean, you're getting all of the tropes set up there. And he has a secret identity, and he's got the calling card, which is the pimpernel flower, and all of that. And
not pumpernickel, which is something entirely different.
Yes, as the patriarch has learned in the past. Then you had Zorro a few years later, and that was a series by a guy, a completely different series, and it was about another caped crusader who defended the poor against the oppressors, and it was turned into a movie.
What about Robin Hood?
Well, Robin Hood was as well, but everybody kind of knew who Robin Hood was. He was a But he was a type that they do kind of reference. They tend to think that the Scarlet Pimpernel and that sort of thing started the superhero genre of today, but the Robin Hood thing was certainly a type of that and it was much older. And that was another thing. We're watching Douglas Fairbanks' Robin Hood right now, which is rather fun. But he was an aristocrat who lost his land or something or along those lines, and he had to become a vigilante in order to help the poor, along with his merry men. And so that was kind of the same thing.
None of which were named Cecil.
None of... yep. Little Cecil instead of Little John.
Yeah.
That would not have worked as well. I bet that was the Sheriff of Nottingham's first name. Does he even have a first name? Anyway. So that also started off the whole swashbuckler genre, or at least it was in the tradition of the swashbuckler genre. Zorro was made into a movie in 1920, and that was Douglas Fairbanks, and we just watched that. I actually watched that with the matriarch and the kids, and that was a terrific movie. I loved it. It was a really fun little swashbuckler silent movie, and that got that started. And it was kind of building up. There were different stories. There were stories about people that had superpowers. But eventually, the first superhero that knitted together superpowers and the Caped Crusader icon was Superman in 1938. That was the first time that Superman had come out. And Superman, the word, has kind of a complex background, and people aren't really sure where it came from. They don't think it was a reference to Nietzsche, but they're not quite sure.
I still got one of those comic books laying around here somewhere. One of those first editions, maybe.
The Patriarch
to dig that out.
Yeah, you know, the Patriarch was a big...
It's only probably worth $500,000, those things now. Or more.
In that case, yes. Yes, you should dig that out. The Patriarch was a big fan of comic books in his youth. You want to talk about that a little bit? Or, you know, what did comic books provide you when you were a kid? What did you find in them?
You know, we got like one channel on TV, okay, for starters. We had no library. Although I wasn't discouraged to read books, I wasn't pursuing them so that, you know, good books weren't put in front of me. But if you went to the, you know, Piggly Wiggly, again, here we go, we've mentioned it twice in 30 minutes. They were on the, you know, comic books were on the shelf there, and so they were 25 cents a piece or whatever, and so you'd come home with a comic book or two every week or two. And it was just, you know, and then I had my future brother-in-law kind of dump a bunch of comic books on me all at once that he had kind of outgrown, and they were these classics illustrated. They had Oliver Twist and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And I just kind of got drawn into it. I mean, I guess I had an overactive imagination, and I liked them, and I really, really, really liked them. I'd read them and reread them and reread them and keep up with all the storylines and knew all the characters. Happy to report that when I got 15 or 16, 17, you know, probably in the 15, 16 year range, I just kind of moved on from those. I mean, I still had them, and in fact, I don't know where they are now. I mean, I know they're gone. My mom must have given them away or done something with them, but which is kind of hard to believe. But I must have had, and it's really kind of too bad because I did have some that were probably worth, you know, a few bucks now, not a huge stash, but I would just like to, if nothing else, I'd like to revisit those. But yeah, and I think it was kind of maybe not the golden age of those comic books, but in this would have been the 70s. Stan Lee, Jack Kirby doing all the Marvel stuff, and you know, you had there were all these kind of storylines that were really taken off, I think, in a lot of those Marvel comics. Anyway, I had a handful of Batman and Superman comic books, but not as many. And so, you know, when the Avengers and Spider-Man and all this stuff comes out now with CGI stuff, which, again, was impossible. You know, those movies are impossible to make without CGI, or to make it, you know, interesting. They're marketing it, I think, to guys like me, middle-aged guys that kind of grew up with that stuff. And but it was, you know, I mean, I have very fond memories of it. I think, and back then anyway, I don't think they were trying to. They were just doing the stories. They were just having fun. They weren't trying to shape the culture, right?
Yeah.
Or change the way American youth thought about one thing or another. No, it was just this fantasy.
They were
escapism.
Well, they were really the successors to the Penny Dreadfuls. You know, back in the 20s and 30s, you had Bulldog Drummond, or I'm not entirely sure that was Penny Dreadful, but you had Flash Gordon.
What's a Penny Dreadful?
A Penny Dreadful is going to be, if you're, it's basically these little slim paperback adventure stories or even romances. Now, I mean, there's things that the public just reads voraciously. They were the old 1930s serials.
It was escapism.
Much of which Indiana Jones drew from.
For someone like myself, because there was really nothing else to do. So, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm not trying to get, you know, the sympathetic vote, but I just that it was there wasn't much else to do, and so it brought you into another world that you could, you know, for 20 or 30 minutes, kind of just get caught up in. It was a lot of fun. And it was always about New York and, you know, these big cities, which, I mean, you didn't know anything about.
I was not a huge fan of Iron Man 3, the movie, but I would say that I loved it when it went to Tennessee. I thought that was so much fun. It's because you drop Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark right down in the middle of some podunk town in Tennessee. And it was...
That was cool.
I loved that. I even kind of... I mean, and I didn't think this entirely fitted in the movie, but I liked the scene where they went in Age of Ultron. They go to a farmhouse, and I won't spoil what the farmhouse is connected to, maybe until later in the podcast. But and we are going to be talking about Age of Ultron today. So, but I like that connection.
Go get an ibuprofen and take it now.
Well, I like that connection to the whole salt of the earth upbringing. And I think that Man of Steel really could have done that, but it didn't, which is too bad.
This is too bad.
Man of Steel is just too bad in general. And I'm kind of drawing from Chesterton here again. He would always talk about how much he loved the Penny Dreadfuls. But I think that there is something important about kind of examining these things and asking, why are they so popular? And is it just escapism? Or what do we see in these things? Why do we want to escape into these worlds? And Chesterton would say that most of these stories are not postmodern stories. They're not about kind of this doubtful and, you know, artistic, sensitive hero. They're about a guy who goes out there and saves people, who does justice, and who... puts right wrongs and, yes, you know, defends the oppressed. And
what are heroes, right?
Yeah, and they're heroes, and people still really like that. And superheroes have come to fill that cultural spot. Back early on, you had Westerns doing that. Western movies, you know, had Clint Eastwood, you had John Wayne, who were filling the hero spot in like the 60s and 70s and even the 40s and 50s. And also detectives. You had Sam Spade and so on. And again, that's a different type of hero, kind of a hard-boiled, tough, you know, more gritty hero, but still somebody who, at the base, you know, like in Casablanca, is a virtuous person and you know, someone who we admire. And then in the 70s, people moved on from cowboys to spacemen, as Toy Story attests. And now I think the movies that we really, that just blow out the box office are the superhero movies. There are so many of them that you kind of get fatigued with them after a while. It's just like, not another superhero movie. But again, they're kind of filling that cultural spot of people want a popular story, and people want to see what new superhero movie is coming out. Just like they wanted to see what new Western is coming out. And I think this is a genre that is still kind of finding its feet. And sometimes, and you get a wild variety of stuff. Marvel is, for instance, very different from the whole DC Comics thing, which was wildly popular with Batman. And but to get back to the history thing, the golden age of comics was really the 40s. That was, at least that was just when everything got established, all the conventions. You had Superman in 1938, Wonder Woman in 1941, as well as Captain America. And that was really popular. In the 50s and 60s, it just went downhill. In fact, it nearly disappeared, and people thought, well, it's not coming back. And so, that was, but in the 70s, they started coming back. And Batman had kind of come back. The TV series aired in 1966, and that really brought new life back to the genre. And a bunch of other TV series came out, and that really, you know, it was able to transfer to a new medium, and so that was a big deal. But things were changing for the superhero genre. You know, you started out with really very simple characters like Captain America, who is simply a good guy. But in the 70s and 80s, superheroes started to be dark and gritty. You know, they showed flaws and they had personal issues, and you had the Punisher and Wolverine. Batman is kind of darker, more sinister. You're getting away from the Adam West vision of that. And, of course, coming into the 21st century, you have the Christopher Nolan's Batman movies, which pretty much once and for all take the superhero genre and suddenly make something very, very serious out of it. Or at least it's much more serious than anything that had really come up until that point. At least that's kind of my general impression of those movies. Especially The Dark Knight, that was pretty shattering. But I would argue almost that movie is less of a superhero movie, because Batman almost doesn't even need to exist in that movie. But what do you think changed in the 70s and 80s? What do you think? Why do you think that shift began then?
Hmm.
Because I have a theory.
I don't know. I mean, I think. I guess the 60s, everybody was beat up over the 60s and Watergate, and, you know, or Watergate was behind you. And
Watergate was in the 70s.
Yeah, I know, but mid-70s, but still, the 60s, what happened in the 60s in Vietnam reverberated through the 70s, mm-hmm. wildly, right, with the, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know that when I growing up, there was, you're talking about the Apollo shots, you know, the moon shots and the Apollo program, Mercury program. Those guys were bigger than life. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I have a good explanation for it, but it just fit. It just resonated with some of the youth then, including me.
I think that part of it, and I was going to point to Watergate, is that just the public figures of that era, Nixon and was it Jimmy Swaggart that was in? I'm mispronouncing his name.
He was a TV evangelist.
Yeah, but he got in trouble like in the 70s, right?
Or 80s.
Yeah, you know, 80s. There were all these big TV scandals. There were television preachers and the president was in trouble. You know, just all of the icons of manhood or of respectability had just crumbled, you know, and especially and after Vietnam as well, you know. And so suddenly we can't trust somebody who's in a figure of authority or somebody who tells us, you know, these things. And postmodernism came back with a vengeance, and you started doubting the ideals of heroism, doubting ideals in general. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's a trend that has continued to a boring extent.
Yeah, and I think that they really, you know, if you step back and look at that whole idea of a Superman, you know, be it whatever that has extraordinary power, right, and yet uses that power
with benevolence, you know, to try to make the world a better place. I really haven't thought much about this. I'm winging it, but that's something that resonates with people, is that we all would love. I say this kind of tongue in cheek, but we would all love to serve under a king that was just benevolent and took care of his servants. And you know, again, I'm not saying that's getting a little complicated,
right, yeah.
But that we're kind of wired that way. I mean, as a Christian, I think we're wired that way, is that we want to serve a just and righteous king. I mean, don't you think?
Yeah, and I think to some extent, we, especially Americans, have ceased to believe that could exist.
Right.
And you know, and right. Even on a smaller type, you know, that, or on a smaller scale, that we, you know, our heroes are really introspective. They're always doubting themselves. They're constantly doubting themselves. I mean,
that's, you know, all we get now from our.
And that's, yeah, and that's why I adore movies where they can take a hero who does have a certain amount of self-belief, or not necessarily self-belief, belief in an ideal, and then dramatize that in a way that doesn't make him seem twee or simplistic or stupid. You know, somebody who believes in something without being blind to nuance. That's why I love A Man for All Seasons. That's why I love Sophie Scholl, The Final Days. That's why I love Foyle's War. That's why I love The Avengers. And that's, I think, why everybody else loved The Avengers, too, was because it really dramatized the conflict between a postmodern hero and an old-fashioned hero. Because the real conflict of that story, which worked tremendously well, was between Iron Man, who's the complete modern hero. He's the snarky, sarcastic guy. He's rich. He's a playboy. He's constantly distancing himself from serious things. He's saying, you know, I'm just in it for the money. You know, I don't really believe that we can do good. You know, he's a very doubting hero. He's somebody who definitely has feet of clay, and who won't entirely commit himself. Who's somebody who isn't, and if there's one indictment of my generation, I would say that it's just that we don't commit ourselves. We don't want to do committing things, you know, do things that are long-lasting. And he's the hero of that sort. And
what we've been taught.
He's got the sense of humor that goes with that and all of those things. And then on the other hand, you have somebody who's profoundly old-fashioned in Captain America, who's somebody who's, you know, 70 years older than Tony Stark, somebody from a different generation with a different set of ideals, with a belief in the fact that we can change things, that heroism is something that's important. And the movie's all it keeps on playing with the idea that he's kind of got an old-fashioned heroism, but that this is a good thing, that there is a place for this, a place for belief that heroism is a good thing. And in the end, Tony Stark has to overcome his childishness and strive for that sort of heroism in order to change the world, you know, and they kind of learn from each other, and one of the, I guess, troubling things is that they've tended to go the other way with recent movies, especially Captain America: The Winter Soldier, in that that was a very postmodern story, and the government was a bad guy, and you know, it was NSA everywhere, and it was kind of, you know, dystopian, and Captain America was, you know, he had to compromise his, you know, and so on. And so in this ideological climate that we have now, it's too much to hope for that we keep on with a Captain America character for a long time, I suppose, but I would have liked to have seen that.
Anyway. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's too bad. Again, they got, not that, you know, I mean, it's just too bad. It's just too bad. Because, in my opinion, is they missed a huge opportunity to say, you know what, it's okay to love American ideals and what America, as I knew it, stands for. But instead, they feel just compelled to weave in this doubt into the American psyche that America is flawed and America has made mistakes and America is undeserving and America does terrible things to other people in other countries and America exploits the resources. And you know what? On many levels, all those things are true. But there are huge virtues that American ideals and American, this is getting off track maybe, but there are huge American ideas about liberty, about justice, about fairness, about the rule of law, about responsibility that, you know, I was listening to a podcast the other day and they were talking about a little bit about the French Revolution versus the American Revolution and what, you know, how they were different and that there were these moral principles that kind of undergirded the American Revolution. And I mean, you know, it's just really important to go back to those. And everybody thinks you're a stick in the mud and fuddy-duddy and conservative and, you know, and fine. That's fine. If you don't like that, then you own it. You know, when it becomes anarchy, when it becomes lawlessness, when it becomes, and heaven forbid, I'm not looking for that. I don't want that. But when that happens, you can't say, you know, you can't point back and say, well, this is their fault. No, you own it. Okay, I'm sorry. I'll get off my political soapbox. So well, where did I get into that?
I'm kind of wondering that too. I don't know. I feel
a lot better though.
Well, that's good. That's good. But and this is what the podcast is about. It's like having a psychologist for free.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just lie here on the couch.
That's what I need.
and talk about our problems.
Yeah, oh. Well, yeah, or someone else's problems.
Yeah. Yep.
And when I'm president...
None of this... No, we aren't going to have any of these problems when you're president.
Yep.
Well, one of the interesting things, and, you know, before we quite leave this topic, is Stephen Gradonis mentioned, he said that we can imagine and appreciate gallantry in a historical or mythic context. Perhaps this indicates some awareness that our cultural standards or expectations are too low. And I thought that was interesting because the four people who had that moral certainty that I was talking about earlier, they're all characters from the past. You have Thomas More, who was from the 16th century, and you have Sophie Scholl from the 40s, Christopher Foyle from the 40s, Captain America from the 40s. And the 40s really, I think, define our last moment of cultural absolute moral absolutism because the Germans are the bad guys. Nobody has ever doubted that. I mean, all the wars after that, people doubt who's the bad guy, who's the good guy. Even wars before that somewhat, but the 1940s, we were virtuous. You know, I think we still kind of draw back on that, you know, when we want a character who has that sort of virtuous certainty, we go to that period.
You think so?
You know, it's a theory. Three of the characters that I mentioned, and I would say this, and I think people still respond to, you know, even with the whole cultural doubt thing, people still really respond to heroes that you don't have to question, like William Wallace in Braveheart, or is it Nathan or Thomas or Benjamin Martin in The Patriot, or the gladiator guy, whatever his name was, Maximus. And I think that those are kind of more crudely painted stories and stories that aren't anywhere near as good as some of the ones that I just mentioned. But I do think they tap into something that's very basic in human nature, that our need for heroes, our need for that. And so, you know,
well,
I think that's interesting.
Yeah, and that we want, you know, we've been watching Horatio Hornblower series here lately, and I'm also thinking of Master and Commander, you know.
Yeah.
Is that is that the authority figures in those series have absolute authority. They have absolute power, right? When the captain, yeah. when the captain's on deck, he has absolute authority over all the men on the ship.
Yeah.
And that's respected. You know, that's got to be respected.
And nobody in the film questions that that's whether that's a good thing.
Right.
Or at least the movie does. I mean, there are situations you're put in which you have to do something about it.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, they write that into those to get some tension going, and I understand why. But the basic premise is that a just and
benevolent authority,
benevolent or righteous, I was going to say, authority is the way to go. I mean, it's the way to run the ship. It's a way to make the ship successful for everybody, and just, you know, and if they all live. That's the bottom line, right? Is that they all live, that they live to fight another day.
Yeah, and I mean, and at some point, you know, I have my issues with that because, you know, it's not the most democratic type of government. But I think there's a respect for leadership and for a kind of more traditional way of life that you don't see as much anymore. I mean, these days we kind of parody it and say that they were barbarians, and you know they weren't.
Well, I say this, and I said he has absolute authority, but I don't think he could have a guy whipped just to have him whipped. He had to break a law, right?
Yeah.
Now, it could be a pretty minor law, you know, to have him flogged or whatever, but generally speaking, the guy had to do something.
There was a law higher than the captain at some point.
Right. And so there was, you know, there was some, but again, I think it's the way we're wired, is that we're not wired for republic, republic, what's the word? I'm struggling with republic, representative democracy.
Yeah.
All right. I love it. I think it's a great system, that the greatest system we've ever come up with on the planet because of many, many reasons. Because, as Lord What's-His-Name said, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. Right? Lord Byron, or something like that. I don't know, Lord Jim. Lordy, lordy. Anyway, so, but, you know, I'm sure our listening public will correct me on that. But anyway, so there's this, we're wired for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Tim Keller was talking about how like 80%, you know, he says you got 10% of human beings who are the good eggs, people who won't go with the crowd, who will resist. Then the 10% who are just the bad eggs, you know, that will resist even good stuff. You know, that there's the rebels, he says, and then 80% are sheep. They're the followers, you know, he says, and they're just going to go, you know, whichever way. I do think that most human beings, myself included, want to go with the flow. You want stability. You want equilibrium. You don't want to stick out in class when the teacher is talking about how the gender gap is the worst thing ever, and you happen to know that it's, you know, not even true.
Well, and you don't have to look any further than our government, which is that, you know, we have three branches of government. I venture to say that if you went out and asked, you know, the normal people what those are, they would struggle to tell you how those work, right? Because they think the president runs everything. It's a big deal. I mean, being the president is a big deal in the United States.
Well, especially now, not so much quite as much earlier, but especially now,
yes.
The president has become such a celebrity, yes. Has become, you know, such a superhero, somebody who's...
He really controls the political narrative in the country.
The organization of mass excitement seems to be almost the normal organ of political power. We live in an age of appeals and drives and campaigns. Our rulers have become like schoolmasters and are always demanding keenness. Notice that I'm guilty of a slight archaism in calling them rulers. The modern word is leaders. And I've suggested elsewhere that this is a very significant change of vocabulary. Our demand on them has changed no less than theirs on us. Because, you see, of a ruler, you expect, or you hope, justice in corruption, diligence, perhaps even clemency. But of a leader, dash, initiative, and I suppose what people call magnetism, personality, all that sort of thing.
Well, somebody was pointing out the other day that, you know, it's like, there was like a headline where somebody said, Congress stops the president from doing something. It's like they're blaming Congress for, you know, I'm like, well, yeah, that's what Congress does.
I mean, yeah, and I mean, people hate Congress. People hate the Congress. You know.
Yeah, because it's, you know, cramping the president's right. style.
I mean, regardless of who's in charge, the congressional approval rating is always in the tank.
Yeah.
But the president has a lot more power to influence his approval rating. Seems like, you know, he can pull it up and he can.
Well, yeah, because Congress doesn't work together. Congress, because that's the whole point. That's the wonderful thing about Congress.
Well, that's what least, comes across. But
at least somewhat, you know. Yeah. I mean, I wish they would work together at some point.
But they do. And even if they did, that doesn't ever get, that's never publicized. Again.
Yeah, it's not as glamorous.
You know, if the president meets with some dignitary or doesn't meet with some dignitary, that's big news. If Congress passes, and I, you know, some kind of legislation, it's a bipartisan legislation, these guys worked together and, you know, went through committee and they fought out, you know, in a compromise and they got this going through, it's not news. Nobody cares. It's just not news. But the president makes news.
Yes.
And so, again, I'm off track here. I'm sorry.
Well, while we're at it, you know, I wanted to ask, where does the government figure into the recent Marvel movies? Because the government is necessarily a part of that because you have the whole S.H.I.E.L.D. organization, which is kind of funding the Avengers initiative and everything. And it's kind of a complicated legacy. At first, S.H.I.E.L.D. is this big, benevolent, homeland security type thing that says, well, we're just here to protect you, you know. And, for instance, in this latest movie, when S.H.I.E.L.D., the government turns up and rescues a bunch of people, then Captain America, I believe, says to the Russian guy with a chip on his shoulder about America, he basically says, well, this is what S.H.I.E.L.D. is supposed to be. This is what the purpose of this institution is to be. And I was thinking, okay, huh.
What?
And I thought that was interesting, you know, especially since we just got over Captain America 2, where the government turned out to be huge and corrupt and behind everything.
He also makes a statement in there about that it's never right to start a war. He makes a statement.
Oh, he says trying to stop a war before it happens is always a bad idea.
Yeah. Well, he's.
It never ends well.
What he says? What
he says? Trying to stop up a war before it happens is never a good idea. In other words, stockpiling weapons.
Well,
and that's
what I took that as a shot at the Bush administration for going into Iraq.
Well, I thought there was a political resonance with the movie, but that's where I was coming from when I was watching the movie. But as it went farther along, it got more complicated because Tony Stark was the arms guy, but in the end, his arms building, trying to build something which would create lasting peace, actually created something that was a good thing, which was the Vision. So that's kind of complicated, and it can't quite decide where it's going. And there was even another scene where Nick Fury tells him, he says, and I've got the note here somewhere because I took notes during the movie because I'm a nerd. He said, you come up with some pretty great inventions, Tony. War isn't one of them. So he gives him the ability to distance himself from that, you know. But it's, yeah, the politics of that movie were just convoluted. It couldn't really.
Are we talking about the Avengers now?
Yeah. Anyway, you know. I think the government is something that those movies, they want to embrace it at some point, but at the same time they're really doubtful of it because it's the American government. And, you know, so they're kind of bipolar about it. I don't know.
It gets back to, you know, is that, again, I think, from what I remember, it's been a long time growing up, is that S.H.I.E.L.D. and Nick Fury were the good guys. They were government, but they were the good guys. They were the good guys. Because they were fighting for American ideals. And now there's this, you know, everybody's got this angst about being American, and, you know, and
well, I don't think, I mean, I think that you can have angst about the government without having angst about being American. I wouldn't have a problem with Captain America 2 if the government had been corrupt and bad and everything, and you can't trust the government. Amen. But he represented an individual who embodied American ideals, that he was the ideal, saying, okay, this is what we're striving for, this is what we don't want to be. You know, but I don't think he carried the moral weight in that movie that was necessary to counterbalance the corruption of the government. I hope that he does in future movies. He didn't in The Avengers 2 either, but that was partly because he didn't have much time on screen. He just most of the time was spent with the whole Hulk Black Widow romance, which I just think
wasn't.
Yeah, they spent so much time with that, it just did not work. Yeah, I just don't think it worked.
I think it worked great. They, you know, but
well,
they yeah, I'm not optimistic about that. I'm just not. They just cannot pull themselves away from. They can't pull themselves away from teaching us a lesson, and I just don't like it. I don't like it.
I don't like it. Well, I mean, I really respect Joss Whedon as a storyteller, so I don't think that necessarily he
was. Well, it's the writing. It's the writing. Get the writing right, and they cannot get it right, and it drives me nuts, you know. And is it difficult? Yeah, but you know what? These guys are getting paid to do it, and they can sit down, and they could do better than what they're doing.
Well, I think part of the problem with Marvel, and they've got this whole plan set out. You had Phase 1, which was the Avengers and everything, and then Phase 2 was supposed to be darker. And I think that started with either Captain America 2 or Thor 2. And
why?
Well, I don't know. It's just that's the way they would want to go with storytelling.
Well, okay.
Anyway, but I don't think it works as well with Marvel as it did with Batman. Batman as a, you know, Batman's darkness was something that you had to deal with. That was always in the stories, at least I think so. I mean, were the original comics anything like Adam West?
It was, you know, no, it was never like that. I mean, and I think a lot of the Batman guys or people, they were really ticked off about all that. But when the Michael Keaton, you know, in the the 80s or whenever they went through the George Clooney and
seriously, was he Batman?
Yes, and the other guy, I forget his name, but they were all what's the word? And they weren't campy, but they were just goofy. I mean, they weren't seriously, and they didn't have that edge.
Well,
they didn't have that edge, and so when, you know, that's one thing Nolan got right is that was what Batman was always supposed to be about.
You could take Batman seriously in those movies.
Yeah. It was a much, you know, much darker and then really, we really got to mention is the Frank Miller Dark Knight, which you've never read, and I did. And it was probably the best comic book I ever read. It was amazing. Now, it had, you know, it was an adult type graphic novel with some of the themes and the language and even the artwork, I guess you could say. But it was pretty dang amazing, and because anyway, that may be a topic for a whole other thing, because there was just this huge, and I think that's what Nolan was trying to get to. I think he was trying to get that feeling from it, and he succeeded in some respects, but that was bigger than life. You know, that was really powerful graphic novel.
Yeah, I think it, and I think that darkness works better with Batman.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it. I mean, Captain America just no.
No, it was never meant to.
Yeah.
Get be darker.
I mean, it.
They struggle with that.
And it'll be interesting, and I'm not, you know, I'm not losing hope because this is Joss Whedon's last movie, last Marvel movie, and I really like him, but you know, there are new people coming in. There are movies coming from all sorts of different directors. I'm especially excited about Doctor Strange because I love Scott Derrickson. I haven't seen any of his movies, but I really like him as a person. He reads Chesterton, which is a good sign. And he just seems like a really interesting guy. He's a Christian. Mostly
and
known
he's doing
for,
Doctor Strange?
Yeah, he's a Christian horror director, believe it or not. Really interesting guy. There's an interview that I ought to post in the show notes. But he's a really interesting guy, and he's got some really compelling ideas about sin and darkness in the movies and where grace comes into that and how you tell those stories. And so, really, I like him a lot. And even if they did cast Benedict Cumberbatch, he was way overcasted in everything. I'm still interested in that one.
This whole event, Last Avengers, was just a train wreck.
I think that in retrospect, it looks worse than it was. I mean, your expectations were probably higher than mine too. But
no, I mean, I think in some ways it over exceeded my expectations. You know, it tried to do too much.
Oh yeah, well that was a problem.
And so, no. You know, and it was just, I don't know how many characters. How many of the heck characters?
Oh yeah, it was like 20s and 30s. It was
yeah,
crazy.
And it was just too much, and it was, you know, they were trying to teach your political lesson. They were trying to do the romance thing. They were trying to slow things down and speed things up and make this guy look creepy, and he's not creepy. And here's a new character. Here's a new character. Here's a new character. Here's a character from, you know, 3 years ago. Here's a character from 50 years ago. And it was just.
Yeah, it was overboard.
And so, you know, it's not like they don't have time to develop these storylines better. You know, let's make one of the sayings in our, one of the sayings that I'm very fond of is, you know, do one thing well instead of trying to do, you know, 10 things halfway.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it still wasn't as bad as the Hobbit movies. I would say that. But
No, it wasn't that bad.
But I think those are things that I can kind of pardon it for because those are things. I think Whedon was just having so much fun having so many characters in that was kind of part of. I mean, it was a really bad artistic decision, and somebody needed to kind of slap him around and say, "Look, dude."
But, it gets back to the writing. I mean, again, you know, I mean. He didn't write it, did he? Did he write it?
I think he did.
Well, then it's his fault.
Yeah.
But that's where it comes down to is that, you know, the pace, you got to look at the pacing, you got to look at the, you know, what are we trying to accomplish with this movie?
Yeah. I want to see.
I don't know what the heck they tried to accomplish with it.
Yeah. They were trying to accomplish everything in too much of it.
It was a, yeah, they had an outline for what they were trying to accomplish.
Yeah. And I guess they just kind of wanted vaguely to end it in a way which would lead to the next movie, whatever that's going to be, you know. Which is probably Captain America 2. Or Ant-Man,
three.
I guess. Yeah, you got Ant-Man and then Captain America 3.
Just give me a break. I don't know if I'll go see anymore. It's just that bad. I doubt it. I seriously doubt it.
I want to see Guardians of the Galaxy because
I will probably see the Fantastic Four. Maybe.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
When I was growing up, Fantastic Four was always maybe my favorite. Probably my favorite.
Oh, yeah, well, I forgot our...
They're going to reboot it.
Yeah, well, it can't possibly be worse than the other one.
It can't possibly be worse than the first one.
Yeah.
First two. Those were debacles, too. But that, so I mean, I can go see that. I may wait and see how people are liking it. You know, if it's getting good reviews, I'll go see it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's... I understand that of the Phase 2 Marvel movies, Guardians of the Galaxy has been a major departure from those storylines. because Great Anna said, he said, all these other movies have taken themselves way too seriously. This one is really fun. It doesn't take itself too seriously.
But that's not true.
I would like to see it because I'm curious about
but
it.
But the Avengers,
anyway.
The Avengers the first one was a romp. It was fun.
It was about the perfect superhero movie.
It just about was.
I mean, I like Batman Begins better, just a little bit, I think, just because I like that movie so much.
Well, the best is Incredibles.
That's true. We haven't talked about The Incredibles, and we don't have much time left, but we've got to mention The Incredibles. That shows another trope in superhero movies, which is to have the heroes start out being loved by everybody and then isolated. I don't know why that is. I guess it's just that we've kind of picked up on our tendency to doubt heroes and, you know. Anyway, but The Incredibles is one of my favorite superhero movies of all time. It's not a really original movie. I mean, it's kind of a typical plot line and everything, but it's just there's so much heart in it, and it's
good writing.
Yeah, and that's Brad Bird for you. I want to see his new movie, which is coming out, which is Tomorrowland, and that's coming out on the 22nd. We here at the Pilgrims Podcast almost never go to see movies because we live in the middle of nowhere.
Especially if George Clooney's in it.
Yeah, and that's a. We have had a request for Mad Max, and I'm not sure where. I don't know much about Mad Max, honestly. I know you do, but.
Oh, they were romp. The first ones were great with Mel Gibson. They were fun. Well, they were. And I saw those when I was quite young.
I mean, I'm just so tired of
really,
movies about that are just explosions all the way through.
Well, that's probably what this is going to be.
Yeah.
But they were. Creepily, you know, real. It was very frightening because, you know, it was this world where there was no gasoline, right? It was basically it was total anarchy and people were just, you know, trying to survive.
And so there were
these, you know, gangs that controlled areas and stuff, and it was really scary. I mean, it was quite scary because there was no law. There was no law. There was no police and no military, and you know, everybody was on their own. Spooky. Especially you're growing up, you know, when you were thinking that the bomb was going to drop any day and that was going to be the end of civilization as we know it.
Well, I guess, you know, we missed our chance to do our Bible characters as superheroes game, but I posted about that in the Reform Pub, and I'd like to thank everybody that commented on that one, because that was a lot of fun to do. I might run through and mention my favorites. It's like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John for the Fantastic Four. St. Paul is Daredevil, because having a problem with your eyes is no problem when you're a superhero. Oh, my favorite is David's Mighty Men, The Howling Commandos. I love that one. Which, that's more obscure Marvel stuff, but interestingly, Rob Riedling mentions that there's a Marvel superheroine named Firebird who says her powers are a gift from God. That's interesting. I've never even heard of that one.
Marvel has
hundreds and hundreds,
Marvel,
you know.
They had, and some of my favorite were a group called the Inhumans.
You need to see Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Do you know who the Inhumans are?
I do know who the Inhumans are.
Do you really?
Yeah, they're in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. right now.
No way.
Way. I probably shouldn't have said that, because that's a spoiler. But it's kind of cool.
Do they live under a bubble?
No. Because
the Inhumans, when I was growing up, they lived under this big dome bubble.
Well, we haven't really gotten that far yet.
And they couldn't
yet.
Get out. It was a... Yeah. Yeah, and the Black Panther was in there. Well, no, he wasn't one of the Inhumans, but anyway. Yeah, I remember all that stuff.
Yeah. Elijah's the Flash, because he, you know, remember he ran down that mountain when the storm was coming? That would be pretty cool. Absalom is Thor, because he's got issues with his dad and his brother and has amazing hair. So, yeah. there were a group of David's mighty men. There were like four of them that were particularly tough, and they were almost fantastically tough. Oh, Magneto was Jewish and made iron float, so that would make him Elisha. Yeah. Anyway, this is one of those conversations you can only have in the Reform pub. It's kind of great. So
I wouldn't know. I'm not in the pub.
You're not, which is.
I exited the pub.
Yep. So.
Which is a topic for another day.
Yeah. Sorry, pubsters. The patriarch is no longer among
yeah.
the.
You won't have the patriarch to kick around anymore. Me and Nixon.
Well, I guess we'd better wrap it up for tonight. I have no idea what we're doing next week.
I thought about that earlier today. Children's books.
Children's books. That sounds good. You want to do it?
I think we should talk about children's books. Chronicles of Narnia and...
That's something I could talk about.
In the Great Green Room, there was a...
Now, come on. You know this one.
In the Great Green Room, there was a... Help me. What was it next?
I don't know.
Huh? You do too. A balloon and a picture of three bears sitting in chairs and Good Night Moon. That's the best children's book of all time anyway.
So
even though if I can't remember the
that huge Good Night Moon fandom out there, tune in next week.
That's right.
In the meantime, you can find us online on Twitter and Facebook. We've got a fan page there for the Pilgrims Podcast. We've got the Pilgrims Podcast blog. If you have comments, leave them at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com or on the blog. We'll read them out loud and and respond to them there. Make sure you leave us a review on iTunes. We will love you forever. And I suppose that's it for this week. Always remember.
So what's up there? What's that up in the air? It's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's the Pilgrims Podcast.
It's the Patriarch. We're the podcast you deserve and also the one you need right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
that's a pathetic ending to a pathetic movie.
I liked that movie.
What's about it?
You didn't see it.
Oh, well, that's why I didn't see it.
The Patriarch's superpower. Super memory.
I just want my superpower to be able to know where I put my keys last.
Well, I guess, is that our last line then? I suppose so.
I guess so. Good night.
All the money that e'er I had, I spent it in good company, and all the harm I've ever done, alas, it was to none but me. And all I've done for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass, good night and joy be to you all. Sorry for my ghost.